Thanks. I'm Mary. I'm alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober. That was quite an introduction to try to live up to. So let's see how it goes. When I got sober, I remember my home group was the Son of Madison down at the end of Madison Avenue on the water there. And it was an hour and a half meeting, and the format of that meeting was to speak for 30 minutes, and then it was kind of calling on raised hands for the remainder. And that was the first time I ever chaired, and I asked my sponsor, I don't know how to do it. Do I prepare notes? Do we need a PowerPoint? Like, how do I do it, right? So she said, no, you've been living your whole life. You're ready for this, right? Tell them the truth. So I hope to try to tell you the truth from that instruction and follow the basic instruction of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I do jump around a lot, and so it didn't feel like it was really in chronological order when it happened, so let's see how it goes. Is that okay?
That's great.
You can probably tell I have a little bit of an accent. I grew up in Arkansas. And the only thing really unique about that was I lived in a dry county. There was no alcohol, which was pretty incredible. But it was very abundant. My parents were drinkers. They seemed to be of the normal variety. And I am not. I am, in fact, a real alcoholic, as it talks about in the big book. I didn't know it at the time, but I knew when I took my first drink, the way it made me feel, I decided immediately I was going to do that as often as I could. And I proceeded. I was 12 years old when I took that drink, and it transformed me instantly. Made me taller, better looking, more popular, all those things, right? Because I was that kid, like I've heard many of you identify in the rooms of, I never fit in, I never belonged. I was awkward. I was fidgety, still kind of fidgety. All those things, but alcohol took that away from me or lowered those inhibitions immediately, and I loved it. I loved the effect produced by alcohol, just like Bill so eloquently said. And I did. I didn't have that language for it. I was just like, let's go get it. Right? And I did. I was 12 years old. And like I said, I lived in a dry county. And so drugs were more available. I should have started by saying I was my sober date is May 2nd, 1995. And so I celebrated 26 years of continuous sobriety. So, I don't say that to be proud of, but I was young. The point is if you do the math, I was very, very young when I got sober. It's actually 23 years old when I got sober, which actually isn't that young anymore. There's a lot of younger people, which is a miracle. Because when I came in, there were people that told me that they had spilled more than I drank. I'll never say anything like that to a young person. If you find your way into these rooms suffering from this disease, that's not a response, right? I mean, it's Saturday night, folks. I'd rather be elsewhere, right? In fact, I have a twin sister. She just texts me. She's at a Sammy Hagar concert. She lives in Oklahoma still. And so, you know, but I actually would rather be here than maybe. I was a big Van Halen fan. So maybe, but I am thrilled to be actually like back at a real podium, not at a Zoom screen, in a room, of other alcoholics. So for that, I am grateful, and it's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary time. So very young, dry county. Drugs are a big part of my story. I appreciate the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, but drugs are really one of the reasons I got sober. So. Young and early, right? I was miserable, and it was just an accelerant, and I went down fast and hard. By the time I was, and it was fun, you know. It wasn't like I took my first drink and it was all gloom and doom and misery. I mean, it was fun. I mean, there were some great times, some times I don't really remember, but some fun times. And somewhere along the way, something happened, and I don't know if I was an alcoholic from the start or I crossed that threshold, and it doesn't even matter, right? I know today that I can't take a drink of alcohol because I don't react normally, right? I have an obsession of the mind, an allergy of the body, and a spiritual malady. I didn't know any of that, of course, before I got here. You folks taught me that, and it was immensely helpful to learn that about this disease. And so anyway, so it was fun for a while, and then things started happening, right? Bad things started happening, encounters with law enforcement, encounters with parents that wanted me to follow rules and all those kind of things. And about the time I was 17, I got into a little bit of trouble and got taken to a treatment facility and got a test, a drug and alcohol test. And I tested positive for a substance that wasn't expected, and and ended up getting committed into this adolescent drug and alcohol treatment. It was also a psychiatric ward. So 17 years old, and I am locked in a psychiatric intensive care that's for drug and alcohol addiction. They, they block you into a small room for 7 days, take your shoes and cords so you don't run or kill yourself. And that's where, I mean, that's what 4 or 5 years into this thing is where I'm at, right? And so, but there, I don't think I have a problem, right? It's just, I happened to test positive for cocaine and I had failed to mention that. So here I am, right? So, so it, goes like that. And so I do, follow the rules, go through the curriculum of the facility. It's a lockdown facility. I mean, the doors are locked. Earn my shoes back, earn a pair of hospital scrubs as the, sort of the graduate level facility uniform there, and finally get out of there. And there isn't much more significant than that, other than I was 17 years old and I'm in a psychiatric lockdown hospital. And one of the things that they required there was, as you're about to get out of the program, finish the program, they require you to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So you go to a weekend, 24-hour pass with your, to kind of reintegrate into your family, and then a 48-hour pass. And so you have to go to an AA or an NA meeting for every 24 hours that you're out. And so that was my actual first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going on the, I was one of the ones to get my slip signed. And this was 1989. Jesus, that sounds like a long time ago. 1989, get my slip signed. But I don't think I have a problem. I'm following the rules, doing all the things. And one of the counselors in there told me I was an alcoholic. And I was like, no. I'm here for this drug thing, but I'm not really a drug addict. And, I've never even had a full beer, so I couldn't really be an alcoholic, because I sort of had this still image of this Skid Row bum alcoholic, low bottom, older male, stereotype that I think is pretty popular, pretty broad brush image. So that happens, and I know that the significance about going to those meetings is, and I get out of the treatment facility and still don't think I'm an alcoholic. Again, in a very small town. At this time, they published the meetings in the newspaper. Oh, excuse me. So you would have to, so my mom, God bless her, never made it to Al-Anon, used to clip the meeting schedule out of the local newspaper for me, and it would be on the refrigerator or on my bed or some, helpful place, so I would know what meetings were. God love her. And so that was one of the conditions of living in my parents' house, was to go to 2 meetings a week. And so I sort of did it, and I was I was working with a sponsor, and I was wasting this woman's time, right? And she had a strong enough program where she told me, if you don't think you're alcoholic and you don't want what to have, go do some more research, which, I mean, she told me just exactly what it talks about in the book. Don't waste your time, on the alcoholic that's not willing. That's a terrible paraphrase, but and she kind of sent me on. She kind of sent me on my way. That woman still lives in that hometown. She's still sober, and I don't have much of a relationship with her. But I did go back, and I said I did the research, and I'm here. And I had 15 years sober at that time, and it took 5 or 6 years after that encounter with her. So that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm glad she told me, there's no point in wasting, somebody's time when she could be helping somebody that was willing and ready. Right. So, so it went on like that. Right. Finally got out of that town, and, things just got, worse. I went off to college. I was a a college athlete, and sports kind of probably saved my, sports and drugs probably actually saved most of my life. It was kind of how I actually made it or stayed in high school and made it through there. I was a pretty decent athlete. It was important to me. It was much more important than my studies or my academics. And I went to college and I played soccer in college, and that was very important to me. And so I tried to sort of get it together. You know, in the fall was when our big season was. So I tried to hold it together to practice and do the thing and be on the team and participate. But it was, college was pretty wild. It was pretty wild, and things got pretty out of hand. I would find people who could drink like me, and I drank more than everyone. And I thought that was a great accomplishment, right? And it's not. It's actually, you know, it's actually turns out it's very vulgar. So I usually start out by saying I never drank like a lady, you know, and I never took one drink. And I didn't, and I won't, and it's not how I drink. And it was never my purpose. I always drank for oblivion. Towards the end of school, the person I was dating was pretty fed up with the drinking and all the carrying on and the trouble and stuff. And I'd convinced him that we should go out to dinner. It was a Monday night. We should go have this nice romantic dinner, and I would have one glass of wine. And I meant it. But with everything in me, I meant it. I was going to, you know, and it was, because that was how it was. It was, I would swear it off, you know, just like it talks about, with and without a solemn oath. More like all of it, right? Tried all of it, tried everything. And I meant it, and I was so sincere about it. And we went to dinner, and I had a glass of wine. Turned into a carafe of wine. Turned into, we don't have any more wine. Turned into a $400 bar tab at the bar next door. He's gone. $400 in 1992 is quite a lot. Not to brag. I don't know. I haven't adjusted it for inflation, but that was a lot of money for a college student, right? Should adjust that for inflation because it'd be more significant. But $400 is a lot of money. And my car was wrecked the next morning, right? So that's me going to go have one drink, right? And that's how it was every single time. I mean, it wasn't that dramatic, but that's just a good, I'm sorry for all the people that hear that story all the time. It's just a good microcosm of what I intended and what the reality was, right? And that first sponsor who I love so dearly used to tell me a lot of things, but one of the things was, you know, you have an amazing ability to fantasize about what it was never like. And that was on and on through my step work, right? Very active imagination. I wouldn't call myself a creative, but I have a very overactive imagination. How are we doing on time? Oh, good. So it went on like that. Got out of school, graduated somehow by the grace of God. It wasn't any effort of myself. And did a big geographic and moved out here to Seattle. I'd never been out to Seattle. I didn't have a job. I didn't really know anybody, but thought it would be a great place to be. This 1994, and the party was over. You know, it was the reality of it. My drinking had taken me pretty low, and came out here. It was the last summer that the Grateful Dead was at the Seattle Center, and I was just sitting in this cruddy apartment on Queen Anne Avenue, kind of a half daylight, dark apartment with the shades drawn. Drinking myself to death is what I was doing. It was bad, you know, it was isolated. And the thing, you know, the things that had happened, the arrest, the fights, the fractured relationships with the parent. Yes. All that is there. All that's there. The wreckage is there. I mean, I've moved from Arkansas. That's 2.5 days of solid driving, right? That's and it's really as far as you could go. If there wasn't water here, it would have been somewhere else. I mean, that was, Seattle was significant because it was the end of the world, right? It was the end of the world. And that's what it felt like. So I'm out here. I don't really know anybody. That last relationship that moved out here with me is long gone, and I'm as miserable and want to die. And I don't know what to do. And And I, and you know, for many years I've been drinking. Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Why do you think I drink like this, right? Like, I have the knowledge, but I don't have the solution. So I have this moment where I literally like come to on the bathroom floor with the worst hangover, because that's how the drinking was going. I didn't know if it was going to be one drink that was going to put me into a blackout or 15 that was going to do nothing. You know, the hangovers were horrendous. The allergy had full hold of me, and came to on this bathroom floor and was like, just saw this very binary moment of, I'm either going to go get sober or I'm going to sit on a bar stool. And I hadn't sat on a bar stool in years, people. I mean, I was drinking myself to death in my apartment. So even my binary moment of clarity has a little bit of fantasy in it. But it was like that. It was just that moment, right? And of course, at the time, I didn't realize that was like the grace of God, that I was under this tiny umbrella of the grace of God for 5 minutes, right? And I went to the phone book and I called here. I called here, and somebody answered the phone and told me where to go. And they told me to go to a meeting on Capitol Hill, and it was a Sunday. It was a Sunday at 5 o'clock, and I went into the club there and wandered in. And, you know, I mean, welcome to our non-alcoholic guests, of course, but the alcoholics all know that, have that story of the first AA meeting they went into and how scary it is, and you're in the car and you're not even sure if you're going in or you're going back to the liquor store, and it's, you know, it's that kind of touch and go, or it was for me. But I was pretty beaten, and I went in there, and I went, it was a hall with several meetings in there, and I couldn't read a meeting schedule. I was college educated, but I couldn't really even read. I was pretty dysfunctional. And I went in there, and I went into a meeting, and there was just a bunch of men sitting in there, and I went in and sat in there, and it was a men's meeting, for Christ's sake. And, you know, I'm a wreck, and, God love those men. They took a quick group conscious and opened it up and had it as an open meeting and let me sit in there. And they put their arms around me, and they gave me a meeting schedule, and they gave me their phone numbers. They told me where to go the next day. And that's, it was May 2nd, 1995, and I haven't found it necessary. I get choked up, right? I get the choked up about it. So I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since then. And that's a real miracle, because there's a lot that's happened. I mean, we're in 18, 19 months into a global pandemic. You know, today's the 20th anniversary of September 11th. I was sober then. I didn't drink. Horrendous thing. This pandemic's been a horrendous thing, but it's not really the big, noisy, horrendous things that trip me up. It's the board on a Tuesday, you know, or it's the Super Bowl, or it's Christmas, or it's birthday. I mean, there's so many excuses, right? I don't need a big, tragic thing as an excuse, right? A Tuesday will do. So. Yeah, so I came in here and I started doing what you guys told me, and that's a miracle in and of itself, because I don't really like being told what to do. Still don't. It's hard to take direction, but I was so willing, right? It was just like the book talks about, as you know, as willing and as desperate as the dying can be. And I took direction, and I took some basic instruction, and it was hard. It was hard. Those first days were so hard. I had a craving to drink alcohol every day for the first 13 months. I don't think that's normal. I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. And I don't think I was doing anything wrong. You know, I was doing everything he told me to. And I started running. I'm a runner. I'm not a very good runner, but I started running because I had gone to all the meetings, you know, a couple meetings a day, calling newer people than me, calling older people, going and digging holes in y'all's yard. Y'all be like, come over and, you know, help me garden. I was like, dig a hole. What now? Fill it in. You know, just busy. I mean, y'all just could keep me busy with busy work. And I'm so grateful for the women in this program, right? Because you saved my life and you kept me sober. And it was like that. It was like that. And I would run. I lived in Magnolia at the time. And I would run. I just would run. It was before Forrest Gump, but it was almost as crazy as him. I would run to Shoreline, and my friend was up there, and I was like, well, maybe, you know, I'll get a ride. There was no Lyft or Uber, but maybe I'll get a ride, or maybe I'll just feel like running home. And I became this distant runner because I was that crazy. And like, I didn't want to drink, right? And so I would go to a meeting, I would run, I'd go to another meeting, I'd go to somebody's house. And I had the phone list in my pocket, and I don't think there was cell phones there. I can remember my second sponsor. I can remember being I used to travel a lot for work and did up until this recent lockdown thing. This is before September 11th and all the airport restrictions. And so I was in Detroit of all places, and I was just passing through. I was on a long layover. Something happened, a flight or something. And it was sort of the middle of the morning out here. It's probably mid-afternoon in Detroit. And, you know, the piano bar is tinkling in the background, and the families are reunited, you know, because you could follow people all the way down to the gate during those days. And so there's all this joyous reuniting, and I'm here alone in Detroit for whatever reason. I'm sorry if you're from Detroit. I'm sure it's very lovely, but the Detroit airport was not particularly lovely for me that day. And my sponsor, I didn't want to drink, but it was looked like a good idea, right? And so there's just those moments, right? We have those moments. I have those moments where it looks like an option, right? And my sponsor warned me about this and said, there's going to be a time where it might be 2 a.m. in the middle of the night. It's just going to be about you and your God. So get one, right? And so so I go through that phone list of my home group. Again, it's that Madison. And there's probably 60 people on that list. And so I've got a calling card. Remember those 16-digit calling cards? So stand at a payphone, calling people. And I'd learned how to do this, right? Because you told me to call people when things were okay, so that when things weren't okay, you weren't afraid to call. And so I was calling everybody in work, and I'm calling people's home, and so I know nobody's home, and I'm just feeling sorrier and sorrier for myself and worse, but I know my sponsor is home because she doesn't have a job. She stays at home, and I do not want to call her, right? And I don't want to call her, and I finally call her, and she's like, hello, and I was like, it's me, and I'm whatever the crisis du jour was still big and ugly, and I was so, you know, downtrodden, and I was like going on about whatever, and she goes, Mary, you have a great life. Have you made a gratitude list? Have you made a gratitude list? She's very big on the gratitude list, and you have a great life. Go make a gratitude list, and hung up. And I went and made a gratitude. I was added it to my fourth step resentment list, but I went and made the gratitude list. And by, I tell you what, by the time I got, and I was, there was things like, you know, maybe sleeping in my bed that night because I'd be home from the airport, but it worked, right? And it's just like, we seek relief, right? We seek relief. And if we don't find the right kind of relief, we'll go back to the drink. So the tools have been immensely important to me. Working the steps, you know, had to uncover and discover and discard all that stuff, all those character defects. You know, it's. I haven't done anything perfectly in this program. I'm still deeply flawed. But it's a pretty great life, you know. It's a pretty great life, and I'm so grateful for it. I mean, the alcoholism is so alive and well in my family. There was a call from the hospital. My brother was in the hospital, and he was belligerent with the nurse. And I could hear him in the background. She was saying he wanted me to call you or your sister, wanting you to come get him. He's in Arkansas, and you know, he's suffering from the DTs, and he's saying, "Get all these people out of here." And the nurse is saying, "There's only me and you in here, right?" And you know, he's dying from chronic late stage alcoholism, and I can't do any. You know, fortunately, I understand the first step well enough to know I can't do anything, and I've attended a number of Al-Anon meetings and know this is not one of them, but you know, it's, I don't know why I get this gift and my brother is dying of alcoholism, you know, alone and probably pretty miserable, and I can't do anything to help him. And so I don't know why that is. I don't question it. I don't have much of a relationship with that family. I've had to sort of make my own family here, and that's okay. It took a long time. Those relationships have all been repaired. My side of the street's very clean. That's not, again, because of me. That's because of the steps and the work that you guys told me to do here, and I feel okay about it. But I also know that that the disease that's in the family is so untreated right now. It's just not good for me to be a part of it. I mean, there's I've got nephews in prison from this disease, and it's awful. And so how I made it out of there is a miracle. And I believe in miracles. I didn't believe in anything when I got here, but I certainly believe in miracles, because I should have been dead when I was 28. I was convinced I was going to not live to my 28th birthday, and probably wouldn't have had I kept going on the way I was going, or perhaps would have been incarcerated. That seems to be what my family excels at. And it happens, right? It happens. And, I know if I was to put a drink in this body, I'd be arrested before I make it to I-5. That's just the way I drank. And I've been around here long enough to see the progression of it. I've seen people have some time and go back out, and I believe in that, and don't feel the need to try that out today. That's going backwards. It's like a math problem. I got to do a math problem, figure out how much time I have winding down here. I don't know. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to the non-alcoholic guests. And, this thing, I didn't want it. I literally didn't know where else to go. I certainly didn't want a spiritual way of life. That's not why I called Intergroup. But I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just knew that I would drink and I could not stop. And little by slowly, you've shown me and taught me how to not do that one day at a time. And today I have a life that I could have never imagined, and a life probably that I didn't really want, but I was just a kid when I got here. And so I would have sold myself way short. So thank you for letting me come and speak. And with that, I'll wind it down and say thank you. My spouse.